next speaker, James Buchanan. The one thing I'll have to read is his title, because it's a long title. He's Harris University Professor of Economics and Advisory General Director, the Center for Public Choice, George Mason University. I mean, he really built the Center for Public Choice there and at other institutions that he was at previously. Probably the most important thing about Jim was that he's a graduate of the University of Chicago, a PhD, and one of the most distinguished graduates of the economics department here at the university. And I think it's fair to say that teachers like Frank Knight and Simon and others had a great influence on Jim, his view of economics and the way he approached problems. But he was certainly, in some sense he was a disciple of these great economists, he was also very innovative. He went off in his own directions. You might say the major area his work was in public finance, although in the course of his career he wrote on many other subjects in an interesting way. And within the public finance field, his contribution was really to take a neglected part of the public finance area. Traditionally, it had been mainly a discussion of tax incidents. So if you impose an income tax or so on, what would be the effect on the economy? And that's an important question. But it's far from the only important questions in public finance. And with the growth of government in the last half of the 20th century, it's become, you might say, less important than a bigger question, namely, well, what determines the governments that we have? What do governments do? Why do they do it? And of course, what are some of the consequences of what they do? And what's called public choice. And Jim was clearly one of the small number of founders of the public choice field. He has many writings in that area, but probably best known for The Calculus of Consent with Gordon Tullock. After writing that, he continued with a high level of productivity. Went in recent 10 or 15 years much more into constitutional issues, how constitutions get formed, and how they regulate and control government behavior, successfully or unsuccessfully in other times. Of course, as you all know, he was recognized for these major accomplishments in 1986 by winning the Nobel Prize in economics. So it's a great pleasure to have Jim back again at the University of Chicago and to speak at this important conference. Jim.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm very pleased to be back at the university. I still think there is no center of intellectual ferment quite like the University of Chicago any place in the world, and I've been to many, many places in the world. Let me first tell you why this paper emerged, or what the origins of this paper, or this lecture. I published a book with a colleague in early 98, which we called Politics by Principle, Not Interest. And the subtitle was Toward Non-Discriminatory Democracy. And actually, that's by far the most Hayekian of any of my books, because what I try to do in that book is to take the Hayekian generality norm, generality principle, and extend it from law, where Hayek mainly talked about it, to politics itself. And the normative thrust of the argument was that, in fact, maybe politics and democracy wouldn't be so bad if we could simply require that if they do anything, they have to do it in a non-discriminatory way. That if you're going to levy a tariff on one industry, you have to levy the same one on all industries. It eliminated a lot of rent-seeking waste and so forth and so on. So we extended that with applications and so forth. Well, a German colleague, Hartmut Klint from Duisburg, organized a Liberty Fund conference on the content of that book about the time that book was published. And we had a nice little conference at Spitzensee in Bavaria in May 1998. And it was only at the very last session of the conference, a German professor, Michael Barman, spoke up and said, after all, if you do have this generality principle in being, if you can have a society based on that generality principle, that would in itself provide a great deal of sense of community. And I immediately recognized that that was a chapter that should have been put in the book and we left out. And then I thought, well, did Hayek recognize that? Was there anything in Hayek which led him to think about the aspects of community that would have been satisfied by adherence to his normative principles, the rule of law and the generality norm? And so that's what this is all about. And so it's quite different from some of the other more general discussions we have had here. And in one sense, it's a bit of exegesis, which is not my normal cup of tea either. But I wanted to find out really whether and to what extent Hayek himself in his work recognized this aspect of his sort of ideal society, so to speak. Does common adherence to a norm or principle of generality in social interaction, does this offer a basis for genuine community among participants? That's the question. Now, Hayek, for whom such a principle is a critical feature of the liberal order, he does not seem to have explicitly recognized the presence of communitarian elements in his own description of such an order. Indeed, the word community appears very infrequently in the indices of Hayek's works. And about a month ago, I was talking to Hayek's son, Lawrence Hayek, and he said community was a word that Hayek didn't like and he shied away from. In part, of course, such an oversight or neglect stems from the fact that communitarianism, as a serious philosophical perspective, some of us might not say it's serious, but in any case, it had not made its appearance during Hayek's productive years. So in a sense, the purpose of this paper may be stated to be constructing a bridge between the Hayekian moral order and the sense of community as it's now evaluated positively by modern philosophers, such as McIntyre, Sandel, and others. The failure to recognize the relationship here is not one-sided, however. Hayek made no effort to integrate any sense of community in his conception of the extended moral order. But the communitarian philosophers especially, they've also failed to recognize that something like the Hayekian moral order does contain important communitarian elements, even if these are very different from those which they often stress. Now, what I'm going to do is first summarize the moral order that we can properly call Hayekian, and then I'm going to discuss briefly my own earlier efforts at developing a taxonomy of moral environments, taxonomy that may be confusing in some respects, but I think it's helpful in others. Then I want to survey Hayek's own works for references that he might have made with communitarian implications. And then I want to discuss substantively the claim that Hayek's moral order does exhibit strong communitarian features, but features that might be quite different from those which are normally stressed. And then I relate this whole thing to one aspect of our own century, which is the importance of the relative size of the public and private sector. So let me first talk about what I will call the Hayekian moral order. The order that defines the network of relationship among individuals and groups in what Hayek refers to as the great society, this order does not embody moral behavior in any familiar usage of that term. Persons do not interact one with another on the basis of either instinctual impulses or explicitly selected precepts emergent from some reasoned weighting of options. Indeed, chapter one in his last book, The Fatal Conceit, is entitled Between Instinct and Reason. In the abstractly idealized order, as defined by Hayek again, persons behave in accordance with rules that they simply accept as a part of their environment, rules that are traditional within their culture, rules that individuals neither call into question nor make much effort to understand. These rules, or what Hayek sometimes called codes of conduct, These rules that describe the cultural setting have not been explicitly chosen by anyone, whether currently or in some past period. They have instead emerged through a long process of cultural evolution. These rules have gradually become part of the set of traditions with which individuals find themselves. Traditions that dictate ways of behaving under differing circumstances and that allow persons to behave without necessary recourse to any calculus of rational choice. The evolved rules of conduct constrain persons from behaving in accordance with their apparent natural or animalistic instincts, but the actors themselves may be unable to distinguish between these constraints and those that may describe the parameters of the physical environment. To act in accordance with the rules, as embodied in the culture, is not to exhibit morality in any ordinary meaning of that term. There is no consciousness of internal conflict, no psychological barrier that an actor must surmount in doing what may seem to be, and in a certain objectifiable sense is, contrary to natural proclivities. The person who breaks out of this cultural cocoon, as defined by adherence to the traditional rules, and behaves either as his natural impulse dictate or in response to some reason, precept, or norm, that person is an innovator whose action then disturbs the predictable pattern of social interaction. In what sense, therefore, can we place a positive evaluation on a Hayekian moral order? Response to that question requires examination of the explicit content of the evolved rules that Hayek considers to be descriptive of the classical liberal society that he conceptually observes. Clearly, the simple recognition that the rules and traditions emerge from some sort of cultural evolutionary process is not sufficient here. This recognition must be accompanied by a positive evaluation to the effect that the survival of such rules in itself legitimizes them. And at that point, as many critics have suggested, Hayek stands in great danger of Panglossian acquiescence. If we go beyond the formal stance expressed in his philosophical statements, however, and if we look more closely at what Hayek seems really to have had in mind in this whole part of his enterprise, we know that the subject of his inquiry remained the Constitution of Liberty. And as his major treatise under that title emphasized, the principle of generality is the primary characteristic of these rules. The organizing principle for the great society is equality in the application of all rules to all persons who participate in the game. Persons are to enjoy equal liberty. And it is worth noting here that Hayek did associate explicitly. He did associate his own efforts with those of John Rawls, who placed the principle of equal liberty lexicographically prior to any subsidiary distributional norm. The generality principle implies non-discriminatory treatment of all persons in the relevant community, treatment then that must necessarily be impersonal. Hayek repeatedly emphasizes the abstract nature of these rules of the extended order, abstract in the sense that there is no differential or particularized identification required. Concentration on this characteristic feature tends perhaps to draw away attention from what might be the moral content of the rules as such. The evolutionary process from which the rules that constrain behavior emerge cannot be quite as open-ended as Hayek's sometime comment seems to have suggested. He sought to offer a justificatory derivation for the rule of law and for an ethics of mutual respect and of reciprocity in dealing. But he shied away from tying this derivation to rationally constructed arguments. In part, this is presumably because Hayek felt it necessary to reject any such principles as objects of explicit choice on the part of any person or group at any time. Empirically, Hayek's inference here that the characteristic central feature of the liberal order could not have been explicitly chosen in the sense of a conscious selection from a set of alternatives, we may accept that empirically. Many rules of the accepted observed order must in fact have evolved. But Hayek simply did not appreciate the potential value of the as-if reconstruction of such an order from a rational calculus. He seemed so fearful of misguided efforts at social constructivism that he overlooked the legitimizing value of a rational reconstruction, and he chose instead to use cultural evolution both as an explanatory and as a justificatory argument. By comparison with the Hayekian evolutionary enterprise, the rational reconstruction of the rules of the extended liberal order makes little or no claim at explanation, but its normative value in proffering legitimacy may be superior, and furthermore, its potential for discrimination is surely greater. Many sets of rules might have evolved, but only a few might survive the criteria of contractarian reconstruction. And importantly for the subject matter here, Hayek's fear of constructivism may have caused him to neglect prospects for incremental institutional adjustments that enhance the efficacy of the liberal moral order, adjustments that may be suggested from an exercise of rational evaluation. In the extended order of the great society, persons generally abide by the law, which itself has evolved from particular settlement of disputes into rules of universal application, the English common law being the exemplar here. Beyond the law, however, persons behave in accordance with norms that may be externally classified as exhibiting non-exploitative, non-opportunistic, non-discriminatory treatment of others, even though there is no internal consciousness that such behavior is in itself explicitly moral and is in this sense somehow contrary to either nature or opportunistic advantage. Hayek's enthusiasm for such an idealized order of interaction among an unidentified and widely inclusive number of participants is readily understood perhaps better by economists. Reduced to its essentials, the idealized order here is little more than an extension and generalization to all interaction of the classical economist insight that there exists mutual gains from exchange between and among all trading partners, gains that may be realized upon guarantees that behavior in the exchange process itself does not exhibit efforts to secure differential opportunistic advantage. In other words, Hayek's moral order is that of the properly functioning extended market nexus. The distinctive Hayekian contribution to explanation and understanding lies in his hypotheses that persons may have learned through this cultural evolutionary process to act in accordance with the general rules and traditions that are required to make the extended order operative. It's not surprising that Hayek was especially critical of grandiose schemes that depend on behavioral adherence to norms derived from reason alone and divorced from history. Well, let me now talk about this classification that I developed, influenced by Hayek some years ago, which I call moral community, moral order, and moral anarchy. The Hayekian moral order may be more fully understood if we compare and contrast this with its alternatives. As I say in an earlier paper I wrote about 20 years ago, which was directly influenced by Hayek, I developed a three-set classification, which I call moral community, moral order, and moral anarchy. And I use that classification to describe the moral environment of any designated society as being some appropriate mix among these three stylized patterns of human interaction. The Hayekian moral order is the second of these, that is what I call, in that context, moral order. I'm using the word community a bit confused here because I'm using it in two ways, but in that earlier discussion, by moral community, I referred to the setting in which persons related one to another as artificially identified units in a more cohesive whole. Individualized personhood as such is sublimated, at least to some degree, and genuinely independent interest does not separably exist. Economists, of course, use the term utility interdependence to refer to this. But that term itself may be misleading because it presumes that separated utility streams as evaluated individually may be conceptually defined. Sociologists sometimes use the word other regardingness. Definitional differences aside, however, the central characteristic feature of the moral community in that sense is familiar. Persons act as if they include the interest of others than themselves in all aspects of their behavior. And of course, the family offers the standard example. The mother considers the welfare of the child, possibly even to the extent of placing his welfare or interest above her own, if indeed the latter interest could even be identified separately. Familiar descriptive term here is, of course, love. In a moral community in that sense, members love one another, at least to some degree and in some meaningful sense of that word. Moral anarchy may be contrasted with moral community along a unidimensional spectrum that measures love or utility interdependence or other regardingness. In moral anarchy, as stylized, persons seek wholly separate and individualized purposes. Other persons are treated quite simply as parts of the natural environment and are used as such. Another human being in moral anarchy is nothing different from a non-human animal and is unique only in predicted differences in responses to stimuli. Now, moral order, which I've described earlier as the Hayekian scheme, stylized situation, does not fit on this unidimensional spectrum that locates and contrasts moral community on the one end and moral anarchy on the other. In one sense, moral order is orthogonal to any dimensional measure along which the other two patterns of interaction may be depicted. In the stylized moral order, there need be no love between or among the separate persons, and no utility interdependence. At the same time, however, persons are not treated as if they're parts of the natural environment. Persons are treated as persons, as reciprocating human beings, deserving of mutual respect. This conception of an order of interaction finds its philosophical roots in Kant's precept that persons are to be treated always as ends and never as means. But as properly understood and as influential in Hayek's thought, other persons' interests as such do not enter in any explicit motivation for behavior. The Kantian precept enters the choice calculus as a moral constraint rather than as an argument in the utility function. Translated into the Hayekian intellectual construction, this constraint is present in the evolved rules and traditions and is not consciously sensed as a potential choice variable. This three-element classification, as I already said, may be confusing because I use the term community in two different ways here. And I use it in this context only in the familiar utility interdependence meaning. But my argument here, the more general argument, is to the effect that a moral order of reciprocity does embody community of a sort in a more general way, even though this meaning of community takes on a different feature. Now, as I said, I spent some time in this going back over Hayek's writings, and I want to go through in what I call a section here, which I call limited exegesis. It's not normal for me to do this, but I went back and I really read everything I could find in Hayek to see to what extent he did recognize what I'm talking about here. Now, in doing that, going over Hayek, I was repeatedly surprised at his failure explicitly to recognize that there are communitarian feedbacks almost necessarily present in the interaction structure that does incorporate behavior in accordance with these culturally evolved rules, and explicitly in juxtaposition with his frequent reference to the mutual recognition that allows actors to identify persons who do and do not adhere to such rules. Now, I'm going to use the practice that I learned from Raul McKean a long time ago. That is, I'll hold my hand up when I'm quoting directly. So from the Constitution of Liberty, order means essentially that individual action is guided by successful foresight, that people not only make effective use of their knowledge, but also can foresee with a high degree of confidence what collaboration they can expect from others. The categorical distinction to be made is that between persons who adhere to the rules of moral order and those who do not. And from law, legislation, and liberty, those who observe the rules are regarded as better in the sense of being of superior value compared to those who do not, and whom in consequence the others may not be willing to admit into their company. What makes an individual a member of society and gives him claims is that he obeys its rules. It seems clear that Hayek did envisage an interaction setting in which persons are able to discriminate against prospective rule violators. Obversely, rule followers are necessarily welcomed into a genuine community of shared interest, even if the relationship remains impersonal. Hayek's discussions of the origins of the term catalactic contain, to me, a fascinating reference that is generally applicable here. And this, again, is from Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Volume 2. The term catalactics was derived from the Greek word katalatein, which meant significantly not only to exchange, but also to admit into the community and to change from enemy into friend. To me, that was fascinating to find that he tied the exchange process to this admit into the community and to change from enemy into friend. Perhaps Hayek neglected to emphasize the meaningful value of community because that to which members belong and which does embody value does not in itself lend itself easily to definition. And again, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, all that is truly social is of necessity general and abstract in a great society. What makes men members of the same civilization and enables them to work and live together in peace is that in the pursuit of their individual ends, the impulses are guided and restrained by the same abstract rules. There can exist little agreement on concrete acts, but there may still exist a far-reaching similarity in their opinions, an agreement that concerns not particular events, but certain abstract features of social life. But to bring this out clearly is made difficult by the vagueness of the expressions at our disposal. Well, so much for all I could find in Hayek's writings, where he seemed to recognize what I'm trying to question here, develop here. So let me try to make now the argument that the market culture does take on aspects of community. Whether or not Hayek himself fully recognized the potential for communal bonding in a nexus of reciprocity, a trading network generalized to include all mutual agreements, up to and embodying the political, that may be of less importance than the question as to whether such bonding can serve as a preserving force for the maintenance of social order against threatened erosion toward moral degeneracy. Modern classical liberals, Hayek included, it seems to me, have generally failed to convey the positive value that may be experienced through personal participation in the social order that is itself defined by general adherence to common standards and common rules. In part, of course, this failure is traceable to the century-plus opposition to efforts to reduce the individual to cell-like existence in artificial collective units, to the great century-long opposition to collectivism. To secure freedom from the collective, that is, to preserve liberty, this was properly the predominant objective for the whole post-Marxist classical liberal. And so it's perhaps not surprising that the rejection of collectivism, both in idea and in practice, should have involved a complementary neglect of an appreciation for communitarian elements in a well-functioning social order that is informed by liberal value norms. But looking at it from this perspective now, we can say, I think, that the individualistic collectivist dialectic was too dramatically posed, as if the failure of the collectivist ideal should have implied recourse to full individual autonomy in some image akin to that in moral anarchy that I mentioned earlier. And this misunderstanding is by no means confined to dialogues among political philosophers. It finds practical embodiment in the reforms that are based on notions somehow that markets will work wonders once all politicized controls are removed. As Hayek and many others have suggested, of course, more than liberty from the intrusions of politics is required if markets are to work well. Even if the essential framework is in place, that is, the laws and institutions that Adam Smith talked about, even if the essential framework is in place, including protection of property and contract and so forth, over to beyond that, there must be a commonly observed set of rules, that is, an ethics, that constrains individual behavior. These behavior-constraining foundations of market interaction have been widely recognized to be necessary. What has not been nearly so well appreciated and understood is the sense of shared purpose felt by participants when, if, and as they adhere to these rules and standards of conduct. Is it not possible that such rules may emerge from a process of cultural evolution, as Hayek suggested, while at the same time they offer adherents a concrete means of identifying one with another and thereby satisfying personal desires for community membership? Rules serve as parametric constraints on behavior, but at the same time within a conscious, if implicit, understanding that others are also comparably constrained. Community, as established by behavioral practice rather than by genetic heritage or religious belief, community, this sort of community, allows for extensions of the sharing nexus almost without limit because there is no required additional qualification for membership. There need be no utility interdependence as such, and no acceptance of ritualistic norms and practices outside the behavior within the rules themselves. But there may exist a conscious and positive evaluation placed on the community of interaction as such, and hence on the rights of membership. By way of comparison, consider the genetically linked family unit. This community is presumably described by the presence in each member of some positive interest in the well-being of others, other members. These chains of affection connect to define the inclusive community unit. By contrast, in the community defined by behavioral adherence to rules of reciprocal respect and generality in treatment, in this community there need be no positive interest on the part of any member for the well-being of any other identified member. But at the same time, value may be placed on the nexus as such, because each member recognizes that only by way of community can her own private purpose and personal interest be advanced. Economists may understand the argument here more clearly by relating it to the familiar public goods setting. In this setting, persons benefit privately from value generated by the provision of the provision and financing of a good or service that is jointly made available to all members of a sharing group. There is no utility interdependence as such involved, but persons are nonetheless made interdependent through the technologically determined commonality in usage. And there is a differential in value between membership in the sharing group and possible exclusion from membership. It is appropriate, therefore, to call this difference a value of community as such. A person secures a positive value from belonging to the group that commonly shares in the public goods enterprise. We may transform this familiar and limited setting into the more general framework of a cultural order by thinking of privately valued benefits that are offered simply by membership in a rule-governed community. There need be no concrete public good or service involved, either jointly or separately supplied. That which is shared is the interactive nexus of relationships within which the behavior of others is predictable within those constraints that are defined by the rules of the common culture. These benefits are separately valued, and there need be no utility interdependence among the participants. But membership in the group that shares common fidelity to the rules of order, this membership is a source of positive personal utility to members, and any loss of membership promises utility loss. There is then a positive sense of belonging to a group that shares in the culturally evolved heritage, and persons may act so as to maintain and preserve a network of relationships. Further, any defection from the rules by persons who remain within the nexus must act to impose utility losses on those who continue to abide by the rules. Note that identification and qualification for membership in the community that I've discussed here does not depend on any personalized qualities other than predicted adherence to the set of rules for interactive behavior, rules that may be minimally constraining in many circumstances. There will remain nonetheless an impersonal attachment of loyalty of sorts to those who pass muster. These will be acknowledged to be players in the game and thereby to be distinguished from other persons. Now, recent contributions in choice theory have suggested that persons need not depart from precepts for rationality when they consistently behave in accordance with something like these Hayekian rules of mutual respect, reciprocal respect. In simulations of repeated prisoner dilemma encounters, Vanberg and Congleton, for example, have demonstrated that the availability of an exit option or strategy allows players to survive who consistently reject the defect option in separate plays. Ron Heiner, Dieter Smitschen, and Max Albert have shown that prospects for mutual predictability in behavior, along with some response interdependence, may offer rational bases for reciprocally cooperative behavior, even in apparent one-shot prisoner dilemma settings. To the extent that these and other extensions in rational choice theory are explanatory, the cultural evolution emphasized by Hayek becomes unnecessary in offering understandings of the observed absence of strictly opportunistic behavior generated within traditional rational choice models. The modern efforts to extend rationality precepts have not, however, made the communitarian inference that I'm making here. Neither Vanberg, Congleton, nor Heiner, Smitschen, and Albert have suggested that the membership based on any mutuality of recognition may evoke a sense of community between and among particular persons who through such recognition become an identifiable subset of a larger population. Interpreting the market culture as community allows classical liberals to respond readily to modern communitarian critics of market capitalism who charge that the market order is destructive of valued cultural traditions. These critics concentrate on the destruction of a particular set of cultural rules while they neglect the role of a well-functioning market in the construction of an alternative set of rules, adherence to which signifies the presence of an alternative community, one that is potentially more inclusive and surely more productive of economic value than those organized by non-generalizable relationships. The market, considered as a cultural community, should not be open to all persons until and unless there are signals that indicate a willingness to play by the rules. Moral anarchists, as opportunistic maximizers in non-recurrent interactions, should not be allowed to enter the ongoing games. They should be kept outside of the effective community by laws adopted and enforced by the political agents for the community. The value of community as such is dissipated to the extent that persons who are observed to violate the basic rules are also observed to be able to secure differential advantage from so doing. The corrupted market order loses communitarian advantage and becomes vulnerable to both conservative restorations of efficiency-destroying traditions and to collectivist intrusions designed to exploit the enemy of cultural anarchy. Now let me talk a little bit about political conflict and this market community. We may identify at least some of the reasons why the sense of community, as embodied in a market culture, seems to have been eroded in the second half of this century, the 20th century. And not only because of the neglect of articulation in the writings of modern classical liberals like Hayek. I suggest that the central fact of economic development over this period, which is the increase in the relative size of the public or governmental sector, that this has been directly instrumental in undermining adherence to the rules of reciprocity in interpersonal dealings. Ideally, the collective or politicized sector may be treated as a complex exchange process. The contractarian tradition in political philosophy embodies efforts to analyze politics in models of exchange. Persons agree to organize a collective agency, the state, as an institutional means of securing goods and services not readily produced privately, including the legal structure itself, which protects person, property, and contract. And as this collective agency operates, persons can be modeled as if they are exchanging tax payments for publicly provided goods and services that yield them privately valued benefits. To the extent that persons who participate variously in politics, inclusively defined, do consider themselves to be engaged in a complex nexus of exchange, the cultural community described by the rules of reciprocal respect extends well beyond markets to include the collective sector. Indeed, in this model, any categorical distinction between the market and the polity disappears. Throughout the centuries, however, opponents of the contractarian construction have argued that politics is not to be explained and should not be even modeled as if its central feature involves complex exchange among participants in a sharing enterprise. Those who reject contractarian explanations, both in its positive and normative variants, advance two opposing constructions. In the first, which we might reference as the idealist strand in political philosophy, the state or collective is supra-individualistic, at least in some of its essential aspects, and it becomes the institutional embodiment of a motivational force that seeks that which is true, good, and beautiful for all participants in the organized polity. Persons who act on behalf of the state must, in this conceptualization, they must genuinely sublimate all privately separable interests to the well-being of the collective whole. Other regardingness must be the primary motivation for action, and such concern must extend to the arbitrary limits of the politically organized unit. Now, if you challenge the empirical feasibility of this sort of behavior, the value of the whole construction is called into question. Attempts to put in place a political order based on behavioral requirements that are really beyond the possible, such attempts can only fail. But what behavior is appropriate for persons who are assigned positions of authority? If the state and its agents are assigned tasks on some presumption that there is a common good, how can those in authority seek to do other than advance this good in terms of their own interpretation and their own interest? And necessarily, the interest of those in authority will be determined by their limits of their own moral capacities. Once implemented in collective action, these limited interests will become the mutually exclusive solution imposed on all members of the political community. In this setting, there is simply no space for persons to remain at liberty to pursue their own separable and mutually compatible purposes. A politics that has its origin in this idealistic model, but with no connection to behavioral reality, must reduce the value of community that a ruled extended order exchange culture might otherwise obtain. Similar conclusions follow from examination of a second model of politics that is often advanced in opposition to contractarian construction. The second model, which in some empirical explanatory descriptive sense may seem to dominate both contractarian and idealistic efforts, the second model proceeds from the presumption that politics is centered on conflict rather than exchange, and that the game is necessarily zero or even negative sum, as opposed to positive sum contractarian stylization. In this politics of conflict, persons simply use politics to seek differential distributional advantage and measure success or failure in this way. The very process of politics pits some interest against others, even as prospect. Any mutuality from exchange-like relationship is denied. If persons who engage in politics at any level and in any role think of the whole enterprise this way, in these terms, they must necessarily shift themselves out of any mode or mindset, whether culturally evolved or explicitly chosen, out of any mode or mindset that dictates adherence to rules that suggest reciprocal respect. If I seek through politics to secure distributional gain at your expense, how can I possibly think of my behavior as furthering your legitimate interest as you might express them? The political nexus of conflict extends the behavioral environment described as moral anarchy relative to that environment described as moral order in terms of that earlier classification. We should not therefore be surprised that the lapse from moral order that seems to have been observed as the relative size of the collective politicized sector has so dramatically expanded over this century, and especially in the decades since World War II. Well, let me now try to draw a few conclusions. There are implications for policy that emerge from the recognition that membership in the extended market nexus may satisfy communitarian yearnings. These implications involve deliberative actions that may promote marginal improvements in persons' mutual identification. Assimilation into a uniform set of cultural norms and practices, including language, facilitates interpersonal understanding. Cultural diversity makes mutual understanding more difficult. This general conclusion cannot be challenged, but no inferences can be drawn that sets up or defines particular cultural environments as being superior to others. It is multiculturalism that becomes the destructive element, not the putative superiority of any specifically defined subculture within some observed mix. The Hayekian evolutionary argument suggests that persons may not readily modify their behavior as they shift among separate cultural settings. Acceptance of the empirical validity of this argument, even in part, suggests that culturally blind immigration policy may be misguided, and especially if immigrant groups seek to maintain autonomous cultural and linguistic identities. The market is not an automatically universalizable emergent culture, ready to work its wonders only if the requisite legal order is put in place. The market as a culture of reciprocity is a public good, beneficial to all who participate, and it needs to be valued as such. Violations of the foundational ethics are public bads, damaging alike to all parties. The exit option, which is omnipresent in the market, is effective in reducing dependence on ethical norms to a level that remains well below that required for even tolerable efficacy in non-market interactions. But both supporters and opponents of the extended market order, it seems to me, make a critical mistake when they presume that the necessity of behavioral standards is eliminated. And to the extent that a common set of norms is acknowledged to be required, the adherence to these norms of reciprocation, whether consciously or unconsciously implemented, must provide a source and sense of genuine community. Is the extended order that describes the Hayekian Great Society possible? Can participations in such an order find a sufficient sense, can participants in such an order find a sufficient sense of belonging through adherence to the rules that allow living together while at the same time pursuing separable interests? The generalized and extended order of the market does indeed minimize the demands for commonality along many dimensions of behavior. But some such commonality is nonetheless required. John Rawls, in his book Political Liberalism, emphasized the necessity of minimal consensus in the liberal order. Can this consensus carry with it enough communitarian value to ensure the presence of internal cohesion? These questions can be answered in the affirmative only if classical liberals become more articulate in their defense of the cultural community that embodies the generalization of the basic law and morality of free markets. The normative ideal is not laissez-faire without qualifying objectives. The normative ideal must include reciprocity, which does indeed allow for a sharp delineation between those who genuinely belong and those who do not. Hayek's own contribution to the victory over the idea of socialism cannot be questioned. Hayek's successors can confront the idea of communitarianism by co-option. An explicit public appreciation for the cultural order of the extended market can simultaneously secure individual liberty, promote economic prosperity, and at the same time satisfy demands for solidarity. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Jim, for a very stimulating lecture and provocative one. I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions, so I'm here to take questions. Anybody? Yes.
Here's a question. In the former communist countries of the East, you see the absence of any surviving cultural or shared heritage that supports the market, or maybe absence is too much, but it's very weak or damaged or corrupted. What steps might they take to try to cultivate this?
I think it's very difficult to delineate particular steps. You can't lay on a morality. You can't lay on a. You can't, especially if you take Hayek's position on this, that this has to be a long process of cultural evolution, and you don't lay it on. No doubt that you can promote it around the edges, but I think an understanding of why. You don't get things, the market doesn't function in those settings like some of the more naive reformers immediately post 1989 reformers thought it would. It helps us understand why. That's a different question from what can they do or what might be done. I think it's an extremely difficult question, whether or not they must live through a process that somehow or another they muddle their way through. It's probably as good an answer as any. There's not much they can explicitly do to change these whole traditions. It's just going to take a long time.
Your view of community in market societies was based heavily on this notion of reciprocity, particularly reciprocal cooperative behavior among subjects, and I think you were quite right that this doesn't need to be reduced again to just strictly egoistic notions of individual advantage. There is a genuine commitment to the institution of reciprocal cooperation. But what puzzled me in what you said was that you seem to take this reciprocal cooperative behavior to be rather straightforwardly the same as reciprocal respect, which seems to me a much higher moral standard. I mean, the nature of the commitment to reciprocal cooperative behavior could be a self-interest, rightly understood argument, not an egoistic or simply privatized notion of self-interest, but one based on a general sense of collective advantage. Whereas reciprocal notions of respect is a much higher moral ideal. You see this easily in the conflict between them, when sometimes in the pursuit of what counts as respect for individuals in a moral sense, a variety of disadvantageous things to individuals or even to the institution of exchange, perhaps affirmative action arguments are like this in some respect, have to be done. If it was not a straightforward identification, I wanted to ask you where the origin of your invocation of the notion of respect for persons is coming from.
That's a very good point, and I think you do get me there. I think I'm vulnerable, and thinking back is what I said. I think I am vulnerable. I think thinking of reciprocation in terms of a market-like interaction, I'm primarily thinking of a situation where you do not explicitly try to take advantage in terms of defrauding the trading partner. You're the Adam Smith's butcher, even though you know that maybe that man is not going to come back, or housewife is not going to come back again, you don't try to put your thumb on the scales. You give value for money, in other words. That's reciprocation. Adam Smith, of course, evoked the discipline of continuous dealings. That sort of, you get a, to the extent that's true, you get a an external force forcing that discipline. But I think it's required, something more than that's required, a kind of a general sense that I don't cheat and I don't defraud. We couldn't have much of a card game if everybody cheated, in other words. We agree to play by the rules. Now, I agree. I think you're right. I think you picked me up on a vulnerable point. I did slip over, and especially when I referred to Kant as the basis for this mutual respect notion. It does seem to me there is a bridge to be made here, but I think I was too loose in my discussion of it. It seems to me possibly, although it's tricky, it depends on what kind of relationship you have. Now, you're buying apples from someone you on the corner, you deal with him reciprocally and vice versa, and you've been doing that for years. At that level of that interaction, you may be treating him with reciprocation and respect. At the same time, you may know about things he's doing that you don't respect at all. So in that sense, you need not bring mutual respect in this broader sense into this framework. But that's a very good distinction that needs to be developed more than I did, I think.
The great advantage of interdependency is that you sort of get automatic cooperation. You don't need a policeman out there. Now, you're right to say that, well, you can see that within the family, but it's hard to rely on that as a general principle. Hayek's cultural evolution, I think, is trying to get that kind of automatic cooperation through some evolutionary process that he never clearly articulated, but that was his hope. Now, if we don't have that, and if we say, well, we need that in the market, I agree, we need that in the market, but how does the market discipline the cheaters, the deviants, and so on? As you said, Adam Smith said, well, repeated interactions can do it, but you're not relying solely on that. So how do you see the process by which we're going to say, well, here we have somebody who says, well, I can do better than the rest, let everybody else follow these rules, I'll violate them, and I'll benefit by the violation. How do we resolve that conflict?
Well, that's related to this first question about what can you do where you don't have this as a tradition. I think you sort of recognize that there are traditions that are valuable. Maybe they have culturally evolved and for many other reasons that we get benefit from. How can we promote it? And how can we, more importantly, I think, how can we prevent how can we prevent things from getting worse? If we have got a cultural tradition in which people generally behave with this reciprocal dealings with one another, and you get deviants out here who take advantage, and they are observed to get rich, that we think in an unfair way, how do we bring them back into the fold, so to speak, or how do we prevent others from taking them as role models? I think that's a very tricky question, and right now, in particular, it seems to me in our own culture that's a very difficult question, and I don't know that I can respond to it. I think appreciating the value of some of these behavioral norms is a first step, but that's different from saying how we might, in fact, treat that. I think in some respects. Some of the things that we have done in the social sciences in the last 2, 3, 4 decades are not necessarily helpful in this respect. One thing that's always worried me a lot is in the law and economics literature, for example. Law and economics literature where there's a big discussion about efficient breach. To me, that violates something. To me, if you make a contract, you make a contract, you make a contract. And whether it's efficient or not to breach the contract, there's something wrong about that notion of efficient breach of a contract to me. That's the kind of thing that I think we need to worry about at the edges. All we can do is around the edges.
Well, it's a tricky question. On the other hand, you don't want, if there's a great cost to continuing the contract, you don't want at any price to...
No, again, it's a relatively absolute question, yeah.
Yes.
Isn't it? Part of the answer to your question that the legal framework may need to be amended, that is that the ethical and moral sentiments or whatever noun you use there must be supplemented by the law.
Yeah, well, I have, but, so yeah. It's true, but if you're using the law, then the communitarians would be sort of pushed to one side. The role, I think, the way I understand the communitarians is they say, sure, the law can do some things, but you can't simply rely on the law to get a civil society cooperation among people. It's just you'd have to have a policeman on every corner, and it would be bad for freedom, bad for efficiency, and the like. So community behavior is a substitute for law that has some advantages over the law. Now, how to get it, I think that's the challenge.
But just to put the point, we get in Aristotle the idea that one must have both ethics and politics, that law is the educator of the people as well as the ethical basis is necessary for legal actions.
Of course, that then raises the question about how do you get the law in such a way that you might lay it down, you see? Yes, sir.
Hayek, I think, talked about these general laws in terms of trying to mitigate the need for administrative agencies. You need a general principle that's sort of self-evident on its face. You need a principle that's publicly going to be accepted, that's within our ethical mores, and consistent with what's just been said, you need a principle that is easy to enforce. When it's difficult, I'm a lawyer, when it's difficult to enforce, it opens the door for the Chicago Business School to start ridiculing the agencies and the government and get paranoid. You need something, you've got to have something that's simple to enforce. And there's a corollary to that, that if it's not simple to enforce, maybe it shouldn't be enacted.
Back there.
I'd like to ask you a question about tradition and the decline of tradition. If you buy the idea that tradition is knowledge of the ages condensed in shorthand for intergenerational transfer of wealth of a particular kind of this knowledge, then eradicating tradition is not a costless transaction. And restoring it is also not a costless transaction. And you touched on something in your talk that reminded me of a Wall Street Journal article a couple years ago, which I happen to have remembered, an editorial on guardrails. Does that happen to trigger a bell? It was a very powerful analogy to me. It came out just after the abortion doctor was gunned down by someone who heard voices that said, just do it. And it said, here we are debating whether murder of an MD is okay or not. What on earth happened to guardrails, to our standards? And when we gave up traditional standards and started down the slippery slope, if you will, here's where we ended up. But the point they made was, the minute you get away from traditional standards, you are redistributing costs and benefits among different elements. So it increases the utility of the stronger players at the expense of the weaker players.
Well, there's a great deal in what you say. Go back to your first comment. I fully share. That is and I think economists can usefully apply the metaphor of capital here. To destroy a tradition, you are in a sense destroying social capital. You're destroying something that has a capital value, and to create a tradition, it's like creating capital. It takes a very long time you have to build it up and create it. So I think that metaphor is helpful in thinking about the relevance of tradition. And I think every one of us worries about what has happened to a lot of these sort of, and this has nothing to do particularly with the communitarian aspects that I've been talking about today, but in general, it seems to me that this breakdown in terms of just sort of the standard accepted rules for behavior And the fact that we are calling things into question that we would not have questioned at all, they would have been out of bounds a half century ago, that's disturbing. That is very disturbing. I'm very reluctant myself, personally, as a student of Frank Knight in particular, I'm very reluctant to say that we need to reintroduce religion. But on the other hand, I can fully understand the argument of those who really can make out that articulation. It does seem to me Frank Knight's answer would be, and I already mentioned this, and I can't ever enter into any discussion for 10 minutes without mentioning it, namely the relatively absolute absolute is very important here. We need to set up a system such that there are some standards, some rules, some behavioral norms that we accept as relatively absolute and don't really question. But at the same time, they're not sacrosanct. They're not to be examined at another level. At the University of Chicago, they can be examined and elsewhere. But most people have to take those, or else the society is not going to fall. Is not going to you know, be viable.
It's a tricky, as you said. Take what was a tradition. Women stayed in the household. They didn't work in the labor force. Now that was a tradition. Marriages stayed together, there was no divorces. Now we would say we wouldn't want to maintain that tradition into the latter half of the century, and we haven't maintained that tradition. Women have come into the labor force, marriages are broken up more. Now you can argue whether we've gone somewhat too far, but I think on the whole that's been a movement in the right direction to accommodate us to new circumstances. How do you, you know, hold the good traditions and have flexibility to adapt? That's maybe your relative absolute, but it's a tough question. Sherwin, you always have a question.
I don't see the operational distinction between these ethical concerns and the legal. I guess it's a point that was raised before. In a legal system, people are going to be nice to each other, and they would appear ethical. And I don't see how you identify one through a man-made system of laws and one through some, if I must say, kind of a wishy-washy evolution about a concept that's not very clear. Although maybe, I mean, everybody recognizes the concept, but it's not clear what it is. So why can't you have a society based on laws that are good enough that people act as if they were moral?
Well, this is an argument I've been having for 50 years with Gordon Tullock. He takes exactly the position that you take. That is, if you really did... that if you really properly have a properly designed structure of law, then people will behave as if they do these things. My own, and I don't have any hard argument to indicate it, but certainly my own reading of history and reading and understanding is that sort of, if you depended strictly on that, society would fall apart in a big hurry. It seems to me there has to be some ethical cement there along with the law. If you don't have a good structure of law, it's going to fail up anyway. That's a necessary condition. But then over and beyond that, it does seem to me that you need something beyond that in terms of getting people to behave properly within the limits. Now, it need not be necessarily the traditions that we, in fact, have think of as Western traditions. There may be traditions that come out of some Confucian-type Asian cultures that would be equally as well or maybe better for some of these purposes than ours. But it does seem to me that some, and again, this is just more or less a sense that I have rather than an articulated argument.
It struck me that you had this very interesting definition of what you call an innovator, one who, in some sense, violates the rules and tests the boundaries, and it kind of relates to the guardrail proposition. It strikes me that somewhere in this construction, we have to allow for the fact that we don't know exactly what works, and that in some sense, and I hate to say this, it sounds so awkward, that if those who break the law are one, we have two ways of looking at it. They're innovators or they're criminals. So maybe there is a functional role for the criminal in the sense that they explore where the true guardrails of society lie. And in the sense that, I'm reminded now that I live in Philadelphia of the greatest of the Philadelphians, that Ben Franklin once said, if we don't hang together, we'll all hang separately. But he was really an arch criminal, if you think about it, within the system in which he lived. Thank God we have a criminal every so often who finds the true guardrail at that point in time that allows us to innovate. And somewhere I'm a little lost here in the system. It's not quite complete, doesn't allow.
No, I think your point is well taken, and I think we can go back to Hayek on this one. He made the point where our sort of natural instincts are such that we're still tribal. We still face-to-face identification, small number groups. But in some way or another, we jumped out of that and got into what he called the Great Society when we began to recognize how to deal with others, how to deal with strangers. And he uses examples, I remember. You have a medieval village, and the shoemaker's in this village, and he makes the shoes for everybody. And traditionally he does that. Well, he finds out he can make better shoes than anybody in the next village. So he goes over to the next village and he trades his shoes and he brings in more. He's not making the shoes anymore for the people in the village, and he's also getting rich by comparison with them. And he is a criminal to them in a way. But yet it takes people like that in order to get this thing going somehow. And the distinction at those margins between the criminal and the innovator, there is no such, it's fuzzy, it's very fuzzy.
The one comment that does come out, I think, is that there are some processes which are really threatening to the ongoing, the continuity of the process itself. And that in some sense, the law, in its sublime aspect, if you will, has to search out which kinds of behavior is really threatening to the process of discovery itself. And here I'm thinking that we've learned a lot about totalitarian systems. And one of the characteristics that they have that I find to be a kind of defining characteristic is they have no exits. There is no place to hide. And so in some sense, the law a sublime law is a law that allows us an ongoing process without cutting off the exploratory process. I don't know how to describe that, but I suggest that that's part of it.
Isn't that an answer partly to Sherwin, though, that the law is important, but you can't just rely on the set of laws we have for every single set of activity. And I think your reaction, certainly the one, maybe we both study with Frank Knight, I'm not sure, but certainly the one I feel, because there's so many situations that if people didn't have some other factors guiding them than their narrow self-interest, the law couldn't be effective. They can do it in private. They don't rescue somebody who's out there because they have a risk to themselves. They steal some money because their chances will be caught low, and so on. Lots of questions. Yeah.
When we were discussing the right mix of the tradition and the official law, etc., it seems surprising to me that you, coming from your background of analysis of politics, that you may not have answered Professor Becker's concern about the right mix in terms of political decentralization. Do you not think it may play a role in finding the right mix?
Well, in general, of course, I think so. The point was made about the exit option. The exit option is extremely important, and the political decentralization gives you some exit option, gives you some competitive pressures, some competitive forces that are in there. And I think you generalize this. It's a critically important to have the exit option there, and this can be accomplished in politics in part by a federal structure or by allowing people to have some place to go, or the frontier in American history. One of the points that's not often mentioned about the market, what is the market? It's a continuing frontier. The historians talk about, well, the frontier vanished and therefore our growth was sort of stifled. Well, that's what the market is. It's a continuing frontier. It's the West. It's the continuous West, so to speak. And political decentralization can accomplish the same thing within limits.
I'm curious about how much you think that some of the modern technologies that are sort of reducing privacy, where you know, so many transactions leave a record behind. And I'm not saying that privacy is reduced from the government side, for you know, within the private sector, as employers can monitor internet use or whatever. How much that reduction of privacy, so you can't just go to another state and take up a new identity, how much more difficult it is, and so on. How much that is reducing the kind of morality you're talking about, so that the external forces that Smith talked about are more and more in place, so you don't need that internal morality. Is that going to be a factor? Or?
Well, without being in any way informed about the technological aspects of this, it seemed to me there are forces working in both directions. It's clearly true that for one thing, given the mobility of capital, it's much more difficult in a way for governments to control people, and so that is a plus in terms of liberty, so to speak. On the other hand, it may become easier for a monitoring function in a way, and to go back to the other part of the picture which you mentioned, that is, it's impersonal. It's becoming more and more impersonal that you deal. So you'd think that lends itself toward opportunistic advantage taking. But on the other hand, offsetting that to some extent is the monitoring becomes easier. So in one sense, you can't get away with it as easy, certainly. So in both cases, both the political side and the other side, there are two forces working, countering each other. Which is going to would win out? I don't know.
Two more questions. Gary.
If one looks at related literatures that have dealt with very similar issues, the Tocquevillian tradition of decentralization and then participation of persons in a democratic manner would certainly be one, but I sense it's very, very similar to your reciprocity of obligation. And the recent work by Putnam on making democracy work basically follows that, and it's broadly similar with yours, and in a sense reaches an impasse. I'm saying that participation alone is not enough, and the tradition in some sense is needed. But if one can sharpen, at least as you have, trying to go beyond the broad label of tradition, what about it? Different literature, say Max Weber and Durkheim, through the lens of Parsons, stressing basic values as the basic solution to what you've identified as a utilitarian dilemma. That is, reciprocity among individuals is not enough to generate a commitment to the whole. Yeah. And how can one do it? And even if you don't derive it from your model or have a policy implication of how to, if you would say label the basic value as a continual thing which is being reinvented, rediscovered by social theorists through over a century more, you could at least work on it in your next paper. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, it certainly sounds reasonable. I recognize the association of what we're talking about here with some of that literature. Again, but I would just emphasize the limits of my own purpose here. My own purpose was to see whether or not Hayek had any recognition of this in his own work. These larger questions, or the more general questions, are interesting. They're not my particular cup of tea, so to speak. I sort of recognize that literature, and I wasn't challenging those. I wasn't really getting at that. I was really looking at, as I say, this is an exegesis of what did Hayek think about this. So that was what it was limited to, pretty much.
One last question.
Yes. To what extent do parasites fit into this model? Either those who either by choice or by illness or by injury don't have the ability to reciprocate and or choose not to play by the rules. Altruism is out as a basis for helping, so do we say that the trade-off is that it feels good to help? Is that the reciprocity, they give us an opportunity to feel good?
I certainly would not say that altruism is out. Altruism is just not the type of relationship we're talking about or concentrating on in discussing this. Altruism as another aspect of interactive behavior can go forward independently of what we're talking about here.
Well, I meant, I insist that altruism was terrible, right?
I'm not sure about that. I just don't, not familiar enough with Hayek's particular comments on altruism to know exactly what he did say. Now, as I'm surely it's not the time nor place to get into the whole kettle of fish that you're raising about how do we define who is to be treated as a member of this society and how they are to be treated. That raises all sorts of issues that we could really get involved in here, but that's not relevant to this discussion.
Okay, I think we've kept the speaker long enough. Thank you very much.